This is Catherine Hastings, and you're listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. Tonight's program was recorded at the Word Temple Poetry Series on September 24th of 2016. It features Sandra Anfang, Lee Slonimski, and me, Catherine Hastings. Introductions are given by Sonoma County Poet Laureate Iris Jamal Dunkel. We won't have time to air the entire evening, but I will include what I can here. So here we go to the Word Temple Poetry Series.
Well, it's so lovely to be here tonight and to introduce these three poets, all of whom are, I can call, friends. I'm so grateful to be able to hear their work tonight. Our first reader will be Sandra Anfang. I first met Sandra online. We committed to do poem a day, and we joined an online writing group put together by the poet Molly Fisk. And as most of you in this room know, writing a poem a day is no small feat. But it's a feat that's far more manageable when you have the camaraderie of other poets who are writing with you. So it was that Sandra, with her wonderful poetry, walked me through each foggy morning as I turned on my computer and looked up at the prompt. She wrote breathtaking poems. She cheered me on. And then at the end of the month, when she told me she lived in Petaluma and was thinking about starting a writing series, well, I was thrilled. As we all now know, who've read at or attended the vibrant monthly reading series called Rivertown Poets that Sandra has fostered at Aquas Cafe in Petaluma. Sandra is a teacher, a poet, and a visual artist. She's the author of 4 self-published poetry collections. Her poems have appeared in journals such as Poet Talk, San Francisco Peace and Hope, West Trestle Review, and Spillway. Her chapbook, Looking Glass Heart, was published by Finishing Line Press earlier this year. Please join me in giving a warm welcome to both my virtual and physical friend, the fine poet Sandra Anfang.
Thank you so much, Iris and Catherine, for inviting me. It's great to see so many friends in the audience. It's kind of like a tribe. First poem I'm going to read is a pantoum. For those of you not familiar with pantoums, it's a form with a predictable pattern of repeated lines. It'll make sense when you hear it. It's called County Fair, and it's a mostly true story. We sat at the edge of our folding chairs as the carnival hypnotist tested each subject. The heads of the impressionable hung like dying sunflowers, as the mantra cast its magic. As the carnival hypnotist tested each subject, I felt guilty that I'd coaxed my son. As the mantra cast its magic, an awkward 14-year-old took the dare. I felt guilty that I'd coaxed my son. I chewed my lip as I watched him flap his wings. An awkward 14-year-old took the dare. He gathered invisible roses and beat his chest. I chewed my lip as I watched him flap his wings. We all believed he had succumbed. He gathered invisible roses and beat his chest. I marveled at his willingness to yield. We all believed he had succumbed, fallen under the charlatan's spell. I marveled at his willingness to yield. Once they're awake, they won't remember what they did. Fallen under the charlatan's spell, my son awoke and leapt from the stage. Once they're awake, they won't remember what they did. Our eyes grew huge as he ticked off each command. My son awoke and leapt from the stage. The urge to lose ourselves vies with the personal juror. Our eyes grew huge as he ticked off each command. We all returned to the need for control. The urge to lose ourselves vies with the personal juror. We sat at the edge of our folding chairs. We all returned to the need for control. The heads of the impressionable hung like dying sunflowers. And the next poem needs no explanation. It's called Blackberry Picking. I climb the highest hill at first light. The village opens its ears to surround sound, a lone lamb bleating in the distance, the yodel of a train whistle cutting through low-lying fog. A single rooster arches its neck in greeting. I climb to coax new berries from their beds, guarded by mammoth thorns, surprised to see such early ripening. Drupelets liquefy in my greedy fingers, compound eyes reflecting light. Nectar for birds and damselflies, I stop to lick them between lootings. Many are still crimson, hard as nipples on a winter beach. The blackest wink just out of reach. I lean into the fanged hedge, welcome the puncture, the sting of tiny needles on my palm, record the lessons of pain. My hands rehearse the choreography of picking, twisting the berries from their stems with a rolling motion. I fill the ball jar bit by bit, mind lost in the brilliant blackness of jam, tuning into the alchemy of pectin, filtering the sugar down to its substrate, dreaming of the crop's resurgent with the coming year. How I love the hunt and struggle, bloody palms, purple stains, the hard-won victory, the first of many sojourns to the berry trail, my new practice of beginner's tongue. And next two poems will be from the book Looking Glass Heart. The first one is the first poem in the book. It's called Transit. Whenever a moth hovers, circles my head, I hear the pompous English professor who taught Joyce and Nabokov. I feel his delight in describing Lepidopteran portent, how the protagonist sees a white moth just before he's whisked from this world. Take notes, it will be on midterm. If this is true, I've died a thousand deaths, done the Rorschach dance with morphos, felt Luna moths suck sweat from my skin with spiraled straws, while I laughed stoically so as not to scatter them, treasuring the tiny opening, the wound that paves the way for so much transit. Explication, that Western patriarchal need to transmogrify the symbolism of creatures who visit the netherworld, drinking light as we do sweet wine, landing on nectar-filled slippers, dying for a chance at the long view, as we might fit a coin into binoculars to gaze across a famous bay, is analysis, not understanding. In the rainforest, I stand stiff and giddy while kaleidoscopes of butterflies play on the branches of my arms. I feel seen, chosen, welcomed as one of their own. Together we glance down that corridor of brilliance we will revisit again and again, each of us drinking her own brand of ambrosia. And the next poem from this book is called Happiness Weighs More. I grew up on strudel and kreplach, pinching crust with meaty thumbs. Grandma and I joked over kneading, grounded by laughter. Butter cream defined our yen for sweetness, tempering the bitter in our lives. In college, I met anorexia. She wasn't pretty, though in the mirror she felt ethereal. I hoped to catch a fistful of her robe and sail away. By day I starved, loving the refusal, jaw set in concrete, spurning calorie by negative calorie. By night my dreams were filled with calipers. Sandbags barred the doorway to my mouth. In time I came to know bulimia, her crazy sister. She holed up in my apartment, camped out on the couch, taught me to punch down dough to stop her pain before I gave it back as guilt, remorse, the great re-emptying. I ran the gamut till I saw the needle hover, then find rest on a sensible scale. Gradually, I learned to stomach love. Next one is the title poem of this collection, Dreaming of Inertia, which is coming out, just came out in the new San Francisco Peace and Hope. Dreaming of Inertia. The river rolls on, never questions its tendency to eddy, need to submerge, urge to transcend its banks. In the slick mud chute, otters turn and dive and turn, locked in yin-yang embrace, keeping time with rapids. Salmon swim upstream again and again, dying to ascend the karmic wheel. Inertia is not in their vocabulary. Children chase tadpoles, clutch stout ropes to swing across the narrow places. Before there was philosophy, universities, books, their feet knew they could never enter the same river twice. The river rolls on, dreaming of inertia. The Railway Man for Eric Lomax and Takashi Nagase. For some, the war never ends, rages behind genteel manners, horn-rimmed specks, placid brows, mouths stitched tight as Bedouin wombs. Will not remember, cannot forget. Amiko, Gaijin, Gaiko. Right-hand man to the general, shrouded in interpreter's guise, saved by education, a clever tongue, the torturer lives in the dark museum. Neither man has slept in years. Will not remember, cannot forget. Butterhead, Jig, Kamikaze. Two ghosts fighting inexorable demons, Occident and Orient. Suicide of the Brit's bunkmate. Not even the woman of his heart can enter. Will not remember, cannot forget. Yellow Peril, Whitefish, Hiroshima Head. The torturer and the tortured conspire to kill hate. Touch palms, embrace under the cruel sun. A door opens, the woman watches from a distance. A single tear stripes her cheek. She steps inside. Now I remember, will not forget. Survivor, broken one, surrender. Friendship, love, approaching whole. Thank you very much.
It gives me great joy to get to introduce the fine poet Lee Slonimsky. Hopefully I said it correctly this time. Okay, good. He comes to us all the way from New York. I've had the great honor of reviewing Lee's book, his previous book, Wandering Electron, 2 years ago, and in doing so was treated to walk through the raw, wintry truth of the wild, where Lee made sense of the world through scientific principles. In Lee's naturally infused poetry, we find the lyrical orbit of a brilliant mind, one that's able to experience both joy and redemption offered by the natural world that we walk through. Lee is a prolific writer, and he's the author of many poetry collections, including Ghost Along the Hudson, Talk Between Leaf and Skin, Money and Light, Pythagoras and Love, Logician of the Wind, Slow Shadow, White Delirium, with Catherine Hastings, Wandering Electron, Red-Tailed Hawk on Wall Street, and his latest book, Consulting with the Swifts, New and Selected Poems, 1982 to 2016. His poems have appeared in numerous journals, including Poetry Daily and the New York Times, and they've been nominated for a Pushcart Prize 7 times. Tonight, Lee is celebrating his new book, Consulting with the Swifts, and as Miriam Kotzen writes, this book is essential reading for anyone with an interest in the intersection of science and poetry. Rachel Hodges also praises the collection, calling the poems within it moments of refuge, a reclaimed moment from the clamor of the world. Join me tonight as we fall under the spell of the natural world and dip into the deep waters of Lee's poetry. Let's give him a warm welcome.
Well, it's really hard to follow that, but I'll begin by thanking everyone for coming, and So we're also here to celebrate. Well, first let me say that Iris is also a great poet, and that the review she wrote is one of the best, you know, moments I've really had as a poet. And but also to celebrate Catherine's new book, Shakespeare and Stein Walk Into a Bar. And I want to just read my my book. In fact, is dedicated to Catherine, so I'm just going to start. This is my first poem. It's the dedication. For Catherine Hastings, great poet and lover of poetry. Okay, and I want to say that Catherine is a very rare and unique poet in America in that she takes as much interest in other people's work as her own. And I mean, I've been writing poetry for many years, and I could count on one hand probably how many people that I've run into who actually have that quality. So we should all know what kind of tremendous, you know, treasure is right here in Sonoma County and Catherine's work and all the other poets. The many poets that she's helped and brought inspiration and encouragement to. So, you know, this is really, I think, you know, one of the really bright spots in American poetry right here in the county. And, you know, this book kind of covers the whole 33 years, I think, that I've been writing and trying to publish. So I could get caught up in a lot of useless anecdotes about how the poems were written and what I was doing. And, you know, I'm sure that's less than fascinating. So if I mean, the clock will soon run out on doing that anyway. But if I start being really dull with that, please raise your hand. Okay. So my first book, most of the publishers of these books no longer exist, which is probably not a big surprise, but, you know, there are a couple that are still going. And, of course, Catherine and I are fortunate enough to have the same publisher now. But this, I'm reading from my chapbook, which is from a Florida chapbook publisher that is not with us anymore. And so let me just get started. I wrote free verse for, I guess, two-thirds of the time I've written poetry. In the last 15 years, I took up writing a lot of formal and particularly sonnets, although I also, you know, do write free verse right now. So unless these are identified as with some form, they would all tend to be free verse tonight. Dragonfly. Form frozen in a past 300 million years old, and yet as modern as this flaming square of sunlight, bursting from behind a cloud and startling her into flight. Now she's etched in gold-pooled light, darting towards some prey, and in her blue-black eyes reflects the ancient relentlessness with which she's devoured time. She soars aloft with captured gnat, eluding arrows of sun, form outlined against the crest of an earth, turning, turning. The next poem is The Alligator. All my poems are not titled by the names of animals, but a lot of them are, so that I'm sure I don't have to explain further. The alligator is standing upright outside my fourth floor window, belly yellow and moist, eyes blinking back afternoon sun. He stands unmoving, tail balanced, ledge perched, wind brushing the scales on his back. I call the fire department, but they refuse to believe he is there. Scientists say that a part of our brain goes back to a reptilian past. So perhaps my part has crawled out from my skull and is wiring away the afternoon in a form as vivid as flesh. Near dusk, he leaps and soars toward the sky, dark eyes shining in red sunset wave, as though they emit fire, the same that warms our veins. For the most part, I mean, the poems that I selected tonight, because there's a lot, this is by far the longest book I've ever published, it's 150 pages. These are mostly poems that just people have liked in this situation or that, so there's no, you know, great thought. Well, I mean, that's, you know, I guess if I'm going to read, I should try to, you know, be interested in the audience. So anyway, this one is called Student. The weakest student writing that I'd seen that one semester was by Jacques Bégin, a refugee from Haiti who could not avoid wrestling all syntax into knots. But one of his blue books contained a phrase that flames up in my thoughts in spite of all the years that have gone by since that cold fall when I first gave my lessons, did my grades. The makers of bright air, he called all birds, despite his vast unease with English words. And so since then, whenever blue jays fly, such lovely words pursue them around the sky. And as these cardinals' wings so redly gleam, their flight is joined in by one Jacques Bégin. That's a totally autobiography. I mean, that's an accurate, I mean, it's a truthful poem. I don't write too many. Most of my poems are fictional, but in that case, and that was his name, which kind of stuck in my mind. I always found it a really beautiful name. And back in the days when refugees from Haiti were in the news, and I don't remember actually how long ago that was, or, you know, but certainly it's not in the recent weeks. My third book was published second because my second book's publisher went out of business. And so it was years before I could get the books and find someone to print them. But anyway, so I always think of this as my third book, which is called Pythagoras in Love. It's a title that actually my wife came up with. My wife's a novelist, and I've had poems. She's let me put poems in about 8 of her books, I think. So to reciprocate, I gave her the title. Not really, but that's an example of, you know, a fanciful tale. This one is called, but I should say, so Pythagoras in Love, that was my third book, published second, and it became like Pythagoras, who turned out to be a really important historical figure. I did not know that when I first started writing about him. I thought he had just been a mathematician. He was actually a moral and social leader in Magna Graecia in the 6th century BC, who was most famous for his ethical attitudes towards animals, although he also actually abolished slavery and emancipated women. This is 2,600 years ago, and, you know, I guess the emancipation didn't last. Nor did the prohibition on slavery, but he's really an amazing, you know, historical figure. So anyway, this is called Epilogue Pacifist. And the other background is that the Pythagoreans believed in the transmigration of souls, which is very similar to the Hindu concept of reincarnation, and was developed in the same century, so that, you know, it was necessary to regard all life forms as being of equal value, because that rabbit over there could be you, you know, in 50 years. And then, no, I mean, that was the belief. Pythagoras remembers how he was the warrior, Euphorbus, slain at Troy, his bitterness defeated in the dust, his darkly blooming blood, armor destroyed, his foe Atreides, so merciless in Trojan pride, face venomous and sour with battle lust, inflicting his torment, devoid of mercy in the final hour. But now his world is green, soft breezes lush. He's been a tree almost 200 years. Those fiendish memories drift into mist. His only enemy is lightning here. And sometimes he will dream in still twilight of warriors embracing, soothing sight. Okay, so this next poem, which is also based on something truthful, it's a scientific discovery that was made, I think, in the late 1990s regarding the history of DNA. Horse. A billion years ago or more, we split. One branch of DNA became the plants, the other animals. Amoeba, ants. Eventually us with all our wars and wit. And so this gnarled old oak should not surprise, its massive knot a perfect horse's head. Such natural craftsmanship, both branches wed in a quaint sculpture, yet exact and wise in summary of science. But the snort you hear quite suddenly, the flapping of tails, unnerve. Then stomp of hooves truly startles, it conjures wind and gallop, courage, heart. Whatever is in there yearns so to be free. You want to liberate it from this tree. Next poem is Seaside Bench Sorrento, which is in, you know, Sorrento is right across the Bay of Naples from Naples, yeah, surprisingly. So the woman in this poem, Wilhelmina F. Jastrzemski, is actually a famous archaeologist who in the 1930s discovered ghost roots, which the poem explains what those are. And the one thing I want to say about this poem that is also sort of a big highlight for me, I mean, in terms of, you know, writing poetry, is that Wilhelmina F. Jastrzemski, who died at 98, actually got this poem from completely accidental chain of circumstances the month before she died. And that is, well, I would just say in terms of the theme of the poem, you know, I still, even now, which is almost 10 years later, find that kind of encouraging in some weird way. Anyway, Seaside Bench, Sorrento. When Wilhelmina F. Jastrzemski found Vesuvius had outlined some ghost roots of trees beneath the lava-sheeted ground, empty spaces traced with pebbles, missing truths of leaf and bark, species were brought to light. Her plaster cast could resurrect the dead, at least as sculpture, art. And now the flight of seahawks hints at pterodactyl blood, while ancient sunlight shimmers on the bay. And our thoughts turn to love, which if it lasts a year, will flirt with immortality. Vesuvius has nothing new to say, haze shrouded, calm. This all goes by so fast. There's more than one kind of catastrophe. So now I am going to explain why I'm calling Catherine Hastings up to the mic. And that's because 4 years ago, we wrote a chapbook together, Slow Shadow, White Delirium, and it's, you know, I think maybe 8 or 9 poems by each of us. And so that got, so there's a selection in the book because it covers all the books and chapbooks. So I thought rather than read Catherine's selection, since she's sitting right here, you know, why not have her read it? So I will step over here. And
I'll need the book.
Oh, that's right.
I should know it by heart.
Don't you know them all by heart?
But yeah. I'm too old.
Okay, so it's right in there. It's
that one. Okay. There it is. Thank you. This poem appears in my first collection called Cloudfire. Some of you can probably recite it with me. I've read it so many times in this county. It's basically a poem about forgiveness. Clouds brush a language of shadow and light. Waves speak their own tongue of dissolution, spindly-legged birds rushing their ruffled edges deep into the shore's sweet pockets and swallow. We walk along the back and forth of it all, sand dollars and wood, seaweed and jellies, heads down, measuring the exact breadth of every word. For a moment, our history of who is correct and who is right is stamped into the cool ground, and the wind we've walked through so many times, aslant, is more like a laying on of hands than wind. If there is anything more to be said, we don't know what it is. So we listen to the sea, to the clouds, to the bubbles that rise from the deep and burst the last word. It was always theirs anyway.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you. Okay, that's great. I only have time, I think, for 2 or maybe 3 more. So there's also kind of a new book. I mean, it's Consulting with the Swiss is the title, but it's also the title of a new book that kind of got sharply reduced in size and is in the back, towards the end of it. So
you're listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. Let's return now to New York poet Lee Slonimsky.
I have a poem about the evolution of whales, which I'd like to read, and I've been obsessed with this subject for 1.5 years. I've been very slowly reading a book called The Walking Whales. The ocean, or it was a sea actually, in which both whales and dolphins developed between 50 and 40 million years ago, is currently buried under the Himalayan mountains. It was a, you know, that's relatively modern times, you know, for paleontology, but it actually, the Himalayas are young and they're very sort of, you know, violently developing. So I just find it some kind of amazing irony that where whales and dolphins originate is now under a 29,000 foot high mountain chain. For those who think that climate and weather are stable, you know. So anyway, the buried birthplace of all whales. That sea is the Himalayas now, long hidden under shifting earth. The cracking plates and lava flows, concealing waters that gave birth to whales' ancestors. Walk, then swim. You could become a species too. If only you had countless years to shrink your limbs to grow a fin or two. But you've just got this afternoon to gaze and think, revere, and stare at lofty peaks' magnificence that many here see as divine. And what you'll cherish is the sense that here's a place beyond all time. Though young and robust as mountains go, these peaks are wrapped in fine gold light, suggesting some forever. Go. Climb toward this vanished history, whale's origin. You'll never be another species, but it's truly so how bright these mountains glow. Okay, I'm going to close with a very short poem. It's a triolet, which many of you or some of you may know is a French form that's, you know, just 8 lines long and has 2 rhymes and repetition of lines. I'm not sure if this flower is on the West Coast. Maybe it is the chicory.
Sure.
Oh, okay. All right, so that concern has been assuaged. Anyway, so what's in this, everything about, I mean, this poem is based on a really weird fact that chicories, like mathematically, they have petals like that are sort of odd numbers, but always between 2 numbers. I mean, it's just, I don't know if anybody knows, you know, the reason for this. So it's called Chicory Mathematician. Those petals range in numbers narrowly, 13 to 19, composite or prime. The flower loves math more than you or me. The petals range in number narrowly, aimed at a pleasant blue geometry. It loves to count like timber wolves to roam. The petals range in number narrowly, 13 to 19, composite or prime. Okay, thank you.
Be thinking about that place where the whales used to walk for a long time. It's not often that one gets to meet someone as brilliant and dynamic as the poet Catherine Hastings. But I've been lucky enough to know Catherine for several years, ever since she invited me to join her and a group of other poets to hike to Wolf House at Jack London State Park and write about it, because the park faced closure. Little did she know that she was inviting me to return to the place where I had found myself as a writer when I was 11 years old. It was a beautiful day, one that strobed between what was lyric and what was narrative, bits of our conversations, bits of bay leaf and charred ruins, still weave through each of the poems we wrote on that day like tiny white flags of hope. It was Catherine's large heart that banded us poets together to write for the good of a place that needed saving, that needed art. And it worked. Jack London State Historic Park remains open today, thanks to Catherine and many other people who worked hard to keep it open. Catherine pulled together the poems written during these hikes into a chapbook called What Redwoods Know, Poems from California State Parks, as a benefit for the California State Parks Foundation. Tonight, though, we gather again, together, not for saving, but for celebrating. We are here at Catherine's own beloved reading series, Word Temple, a reading she's been running for 10 years, right? To celebrate her newest collection of poems, Shakespeare and Stein Walk into a Bar. I love that title. Which was recently published by Spuytendyvil. I had to get something wrong. All right, I apologize. In New York City. It's a book that Malachi Black describes as being animated by the two most rewarding replenishing of poetic forces, dexterous formal diversity and a fierce, unflinching searching. Where to go from here? The book begins, lifting us through the world we've left to ourselves and singing us to the last still point where we too dissolve with all of its findings, its way somewhere. Shakespeare and Stein Walk into a Bar is more than a collection of poems. It is a quest fulfilled by destination. Catherine is the author of two other full-length poetry collections, Cloudfire and Nighthawks. Her poems have appeared in numerous journals, anthologies, and other publications. She is Poet Laureate. I'm going to say it wrong. She is former Poet Laureate of Sonoma County. While she served as Poet Laureate, she edited the anthology Digging Our Poetic Roots, Poems from Sonoma County, a project that brought poets together of all ages and backgrounds. Please help me providing a warm Word Temple welcome to the one and only Catherine Hastings.
That was great. So after another year and a few months, Iris, you too will be Poet Laureate Emerita.
I should learn how to say it.
Great. I want to thank Sandra and Lee for coming all the way from New York for this. It's just wonderful to have you here. Sandra, it was great to hear you read. Iris, thank you again for introducing everyone tonight, and thanks to Jody Hoddle for pouring vino back there. So while serving as Sonoma County Poet Laureate, I send out a number of mini essays to people and encourage them to write poems in response. This led not only to the anthology you see here tonight, but to a good number of new poems that I wrote myself. So many of the poems in Shakespeare and Stein Walk into a Bar were written as an experiment. I took the last word of each line of a number of Shakespeare sonnets and wrote sonnets of my own using those same last words on each line. And they are not true sonnets. I allowed the poems to kind of take on the rhythms that each one of them wanted, depending on the subject matter, because I like breaking rules. Always have. So I'm going to start out by reading Sonnet 118 by William Shakespeare, so you'll get an idea of what I did here. Like as to make our appetites more keen, with eager compounds we our palate urge, as, to prevent our maladies unseen, we sicken to shun sickness when we purge. Even so, being full of your ne'er cloying sweetness, to bitter sauces did I frame my feeding, and sick of welfare, found a kind of meatness, to be diseased ere that there was true needing. Thus policy and love to anticipate, the ills that were not grew to faults assured, and brought to medicine a healthful state, which rank of goodness would by ill be cured. But thence I learn and find the lesson true, drugs poison him that so fell sick of you. That's Shakespeare's 118. Now, without playing my violin too loudly, I will say that as a child, I wasn't fed much. And one day, while I was writing these poems, I read an article about a spider that would sacrifice her body for her babies. And that's where my Sonnet 118 came from, using the same end words. There are spiderlings whose motherlings are keen to whet their appetites. For formula, real spider women urge their sacklings to dissolve them from the inside out. Unseen until the feast is finished, the selfless superhero mother purge. Some mothers circle their babes with silky sweetness, then tap and tremble the web to rouse their feeding nature, a frenzied swarm of death strike to mother meatness. Leggy mama awakens them and their kneading, presses herself into them, doesn't bother to anticipate the split second between dinner bell vibration and assured mother eating. Once, in an unsacrificing state, a boy man smacked a spider with his shoe, thought it cured his fear until her thousands of babes, poisonless but true, sprang forth with, "What has your mother done lately for you?" So that's 118. The Stein in the title, of course, is Gertrude Stein. She appears several times in the book, as does Cubism and Picasso and things of that nature. So I'm going to read what the sonnet that gave this book its title. It's sonnet number 4. Shakespeare and Stein walk into a bar. They spend in the bar a day or two or a day times 4 talking legacy. "Lo, lo, lo," saith William, pointing to his thunder. "Lend me the stars, and I will set them wherefore, etc., to be free." Gertrude, 4 times in 4 ways, says, "Alice, Alice, Alice." "Abuse not my ears," says Shakespeare, "for my name is ungored. Give me 14 straight lines, 2 indented like so to use, and I will see thyself in decay." "You say you live," sniffs Gertrude in a bar on a stool with 4 legs. "Alone is alone is alone, I say." Will, over an olive, "Don't deceive yourself, Gertie. The gracious light shines on me. Gone are the gusts of your lifting belly and tender buttons." They leave. Windows reflect 2 bards breasting through their pain. "Thee," they whisper in unbarred shadows. "Ye, you, thee will always be." 79. "What were my golden locks worth before love's aid transformed them from falsely named gentle grace to rolling snakes, my head crowned with hissing? Decayed to nothing are lies of sweet subservience and hiding in this place. On the beauty of my eyes, named love-inspiring, no argument. But I prefer those whirls of blood in the whites as I pen my history, an independent woman no god or goddess could invent or destroy. My skin, called roseate and milk white, again and again, turns green as the grass, as the woods, as the word itself. To this woman or that man or to myself, I will give slithering hair, bleeding eyes, the pasture of my skin, to afford the freedom to walk with one or alone, to love and live with a curse that is not at all a curse, as those on high say, but deliverance, a nameless liberation for which even you would pay." And this poem goes back to the late 60s, early 70s, and you'll know that from the language. It's sonnet number 12. "Hubba hubba, mamacita, the first line has to do with time. Even if we start in the cold blue morning, we'll make our way to night. Oh, night, oh, night, oh, night, you were the hot red wheel of our prime, when we'd stroll from bar to bar, band to band, on the clean white walks of loneliness. Skirts and shirts waved to the beat like leaves on a trembling tree, and it was easy then to go along with the herd. We talked astrology and earth shoes and scribbled sheaves of phone numbers on matchbooks. We were free as the beard of Walt Whitman, as cool as Keystone Corner, ready to make out, make up, make do, make a scene, make every off-work moment to go. Whose lips were waiting? Whose tongue? Who could forsake the explosion of the butterfly, the rainbow bus, the scent of the grove? Under the bridge, the carrier carried white-capped men of defense. In the holds, they held themselves and will rock themselves hence." '60. "We escape ourselves by walking along the shore. Nearby, the cliffs are high and, in the end, more skilled with the vertigo of loss than I. Before the day drops out of sight, we silently contend with floating above language, above what we know, light in its western fall, squandered over the world newly crowned with doubling, redoubling stars. Side by side loners, we fight off the pull to feel as the cards tell us we should. Confound the messages of unity spoon-fed to heart-sick youth. As we stroll, which is to say the 10 of us at least, your brow changes shape like a cloud. Your arms, I speak the truth, are tender creatures ready for the service of love. They mow down the pain of the past where I often take a stand, bury fear for good again, singing life passed hand to hand.
And I'm just going to read one more from the section of this book, and then I'll get off the sonnets. This is number 5, and it's kind of, Ed Colletti calls these my jazz sonnets. Mamma mia, Mama Thornton, Moms Mably, your frame is the frame, is the breath, is the beat, is the jazz where we dwell. Mother Teresa, Mother Mary, Mother Jones, all the same blues news and bebop biscuits baked up in blackened caves. Excel, excellent Earth Mother, and the nurse named Freeborn. Go on with your love of the song and the sound and the rushing water there, pouring into the bowl, washing the hands of Gertrude. Gone is the gone, that square mother of squarer words. Everywhere, under the earth, mother's dreams birth and mingle. Hound dogs and Picasso left cubed bones, white robes and blue robes wiped softly, hot breath from glass. Oh, mother, may we speak of them? We're not crying babes bereft of longing or blue as blue singers. We're mothers, every man of us, or was. With Lee's permission, I'd like to read a poem I wrote for him a year ago at this time when his mother passed away.
No.
Too bad. Son for Lee Slonimsky. What calms the breathless, nameless loss when a mother is freed from earth? What disentangles memory from reality, bearable from unbearable, angles of the womb suddenly sharp as cut jewels? Whose palms will press together, having never met before? Is it human nature, even in September, to wish for the hush of snow, to walk lonely paths in search of a white intaglio, to lie curled in as a babe, wailing, where, to the woman? The hand that held your head is now at rest, but not the love that flows from breast to breast. True comfort weighs as much as a feather. It's time that gives strength, and though grief never leaves, it changes. The infinities of loss and healing offer each their length. One of the forms that I had fun with during that time of experimenting is the Dagwood. And a Dagwood can have as many stanzas as you want, and then you take them and you braid all of them together to create the third stanza. So this Dagwood has two stanzas that are then braided together to form the third stanza. North Coast Dagwood. Wind-carved trees bend to ground. Small leaves soar into air. Over coral-colored cliffs painted with flowers of California light, a lone walker north to south, beyond the waves, beyond the world. A gopher feeds on a berry a woman has dropped at her feet. What does that gopher see with his tiny black eyes? A sea silvered by wind, a tossing boat, a sky infused with fire? Wind-carved trees bend to ground. A gopher feeds on a berry. Small leaves soar into air. A woman has dropped at her feet. Over coral-colored cliffs, what does that gopher see, painted with flowers, with his tiny black eyes of California light? A sea silvered by wind, a lone walker north to south, a tossing boat beyond the waves, beyond the world, a sky infused with fire. That's a Dagwood. My Aunt Eunice was a very tragic figure First of all, she was named Eunice. but she really had a very sad life. She was a wonderful, wonderful woman. She had an infant that was kidnapped from the front yard of her home that she never saw again. She turned to alcohol, and that's what killed her in the end. And she worked for a mortuary, and she applied makeup to corpses. And I remember being terrified as a child, hearing her talk about how sometimes these bodies would just sit up while she was working on them. Just like, look, you know. So this is a villanelle. I thought it was a good form to write about this in. Her troubles. For a living, she dressed the naked dead, painted tattered lips with spring's first rose. Sometimes a woman would raise her head, remembering the children hadn't been fed, knowing what everyone else knows. For a living, she dressed the naked dead. Now retired, she rises slow from her bed. Early mornings, Irish whiskey flows. Sometimes a woman would raise her head. Hours at the mirror, blush and lashes spread, glass in hand, her pasty makeup shows. For a living, she dressed the naked dead. Glass empty, space husband in bed. She drives to the store in her nightie, torn hose. Sometimes a woman would raise her head. She pushes her cart past the milk, past the bread, lines it with bottles, for looks, two tomatoes. For a living, she dressed the naked dead. Sometimes a woman would raise her head. Those of you who know me know that in every book that I put together, I have to have at least one poem that has something to do with the great Spanish poet Federico García Lorca. This is no exception. The poem I'm going to read in this book is called Menor, which translates to minor, as in underage. And it has to do with, in 2012, they discovered the name of Lorca's last lover, who was a minor, and it is surmised that if he had not been a minor and if he was able to leave the country, the two men would have fled Spain and Lorca would not have been assassinated by the fascists. There's a line in Spanish in here that I want to translate for you, and let's see, it's Ay voz secreta del amor is the line, and it translates to O secret voice of dark love. Menor. Look, they are lying in ambush for us still. From the beloved sleeps on the poet's breast, Federico García Lorca. After 70 years, García Lorca, the stars have brought us the name of your last love. The dusk of nightingales, the soft-necked dove, his name, your trembling flesh, all in a box, sheltered from eyes that would eat you whole. Juan, he whispered, Juan, here is my breast, a broken moon, the dahlia of my blood. García Lorca, but for this boy, the underground cell of your center, you may have left Spain, may not have been executed with the bullfighters and one-legged schoolteacher. The more we know, the more the clouds fill our mouths. Poeta, poeta. In the box, an orange blossom from Granada, a testament of desperate desire. I can't even look at him, you say. Do we wish you hadn't? No. We cradle the coffin of poems and letters. Ay, voz secreta del amor oscuro. We resume looking for your bones, the hard ivory of your head. We cannot break our mourning for the lily lost before the bloom. Poeta dulce, ¿dónde están? Where are you? So I'm going to end with three love poems, two of them to my motorcycles, and one to Kathy. So I'm going to read a poem called Motorcycle Diary in Progressive Form. And for those of you who do not know motorcycles, every time I say a number, like 350 or something, that refers to the size of the engine. So the bigger the number, the bigger the engine. Okay. So Motorcycle Diary in Progressive Form.
My first was a 350. I learned to ride facing a wall of baby pines on the front lawn. She was gold with a black streak, and soon we were flying down 140, past the smell of fried clams and fraps at Freights on the Lake. One by one, the chains of existence from 17 years back to just the day before, thrown off, because this is what happens in flight. And I loved the feeling, so when I left that life behind, returned home to San Francisco, I bought a 400 this time, a room with a black streak, and we rode the smooth, sweeping roads down to San Diego, where I felt she had been too light for the wind, traded her in for a 650, broke her in slowly to Mexico, then home to Twin Peaks and Market Street, where I loved her slow-moving hotness in the oh-so-gay parade, my old wedding dress dragging behind like a forsaken cloud, then up the coast and over the Canadian Rockies, where I was snowed in Banff, gusted in Calgary, where I begged truckers to rescue us, but truck insurance doesn't cover that kind of thing. So I drove south through Idaho, past the Snake River with its red rocks, its slate shadows of hawks, down, down to Sacramento, where a bee caught like a shard of glass in my scarf, stung my throat, forced me to lay that bike down in the breakdown lane until the dizziness passed, and then we were on to our new home in Sebastopol, where I had no garage and had to heave her up every morning off the rush hour street like a horse knocked down in pasture. So I sold her and didn't ride again for over 30 years until I remembered, sweet Jesus, time was flying by, not me. So I bought a 700, all black, the only streak me, a silver-haired woman, soaring solo past vineyards, lagoons, rivers, valleys, redwoods, mustard, the blue meadow of sea, like a bird who knows nothing of years but everything of release and the sensation of oneness with the thing that sets you free.
Thank you. The next motorcycle poem is very short. It's in the form of a rispetto. And a rispetto is an old Italian form, and they think it was first written to admire a woman. And since my motorcycle is a she, I figured, what the hell? So this is Motorcycle Rispetto. When I work my tired duties, the red blood of me lies crypt cold. When I ride off on black beauty, I become too young to be old. Freed up to flee and hum the roads in this moment-to-moment glee, I twist her throttle. She explodes past pastures to the thrashing sea. So this one is the last one, and it is for Kathy. Blue and gold ferries are busy today. In the bay where white caps rise, spit themselves into the wind, rise again like feathers flung. Those flecks spell our words, white words against blue sky, before falling into the illegible roil of water. Beyond the bridge, the sinking sun splits above the sea. Last night in moonlight, long fingers of trees signed their language the way deaf women sign. I read one word, you another, an unfolding of desire all the way to its center. Look, a sea lion raises his head, watches with liquid eyes as the bay settles at last into green. The sky molten, words and water enmeshed in the coming dark. We too dissolve, two older, easygoing birds, whirring our wings, whispering forever to October shadows. Thank you so much. Thank you.